This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The search for life on Mars has gotten a lot of press over the past few years, with probes and remote control explorers roaming the red planet for signs and clues. But research is also being done on meteorites that were found in one of the most barren environments on our planet.
So the reason we go to Antarctica, because the rock is black, the ice is kind of a bluish color, and you can see them. They stand out. If there's a rock in the middle of an ice field, there's only one place it came from.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series continues with the search for and study of microbial life on Mars that may have hitched a ride to Earth. We'll also spend an academic minute with some Earthbound microbes that are a little bit gassy. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When searching for the origins of life, sooner or later there's going to be a microscope involved. Turns out it's the same when searching for life on Mars. This is how we came to speak with Dr. Andrew Steele, a researcher at the Carnegie Institution Geophysical Laboratory. Recently, Dr. Steele has been studying and speaking on Martian organics and the search for life on the fourth planet from the sun. He spoke about his work with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. It appears science has been his passion for as long as he can remember.
Since I was a kid, reading science fiction was a segue into my interest in the outer solar system. I think seeing Carl Sagan's program way back also kind of got me interested in the solar system and extraterrestrial issues, shall we say. But I think it's one of those things that it's a natural draw, isn't it? Anyone who looks up at night, anyone who sees the stars and wonders about their place in the universe is going to be interested in it. And at that time, I think the thing with Carl Sagan made me realize that you could actually be a part of it if you wanted to.
Well, as you go forward, I see you use traditional and biotechnological approaches for the detection of microbial life in astrobiology and solar system exploration. What the heck does that mean, Dr. Steele?
Well, I try to look at ways in which you would find life if it was present in any particular samples. A great example of this has been a work in meteorites.
From Mars?
Both Martian and meteorites from the asteroid belt, carbonate chondrites, what they're called chondrites and normal meteorites. It became obvious very early in my involvement in astrobiology that a lot of Earth organisms were messing with samples, and I was just trying to understand the influence of Earth organisms on those kind of samples.
So in other words, to really know that it's life from somewhere else, you have to separate out whatever this piece of rock has impacted on the Earth, and therefore pieces of that Earth microbial life will be in there.
Yeah, obviously, as soon as a meteorite hits the Earth starts to influence what's in the meteorite and add to it, try to change it. So it's understanding that process. And it was an initial thing that I was looking at. I went to work at the Johnson Space Center with Dave McKay after the 96 announcement of life in a meteorite. It was an Antarctic meteorite.
Oh, in Antarctic.
Yeah,
okay.
ALH84001. And another very, very interesting signs in that meteorite. I have something from Mars, but it's taken a long, long time to start to pull out the signals of the chemistry going on in that meteorite. So initially, I found an Earth organism in the meteorite. Dave McKay, who was the principal investigator, showed me some samples that had some interesting forms and features in and said, what are these? And I went away and looked at them and did some analysis, and we showed that they were contaminant organisms, probably from Antarctica. But at the same time, a lot of people were looking at the meteorite and saying, well, there's no life in this meteorite. And it's kind of, well, there's a disconnect here. There is life. It's Earth life. So why aren't we finding that? What do we need to do to be more robust in taking each of the inputs, the Earth life input, possible Martian life input, and separating them so that we can make the analysis robust, so we can do it the same every time?
That can't be a simple process.
Well, no, it's not. I mean, this started in 97, 98 for me, and I think we published on showing that there was definitely a Martian organic component to ALH, supporting the original hypothesis from Dave McKay about the presence of organic material, which is a carbon-based material, in the meteorite. As for the life argument, well, it's how you look at the problem. And unfortunately, I can't say either way. But the way I would look at the problem is to, if I'm looking for life, is to say there is no life and try and disprove that hypothesis, which is, I think, the best way of doing it as a microbiologist. That's the way you're taught to look at any problem. And unfortunately, I can't disprove the hypothesis that there is no life.
What I'm interested in, though, is what is this? What does it look like? I assume you're using a microscope, a very powerful microscope, when you look at these, this microbial life. What does it look like? If you know, you're separating what is, quote, earth-like, organic, is this process both microscopic, chemical? I mean, how are you doing this?
There are many different techniques we throw at it. The organic chemistry in the Martian meteorites is associated with kind of test tube chemistry. It's stuff that you would do in a lab and that, given the right conditions, will happen anywhere.
So you take a sample of that meteorite, you mix it in a test tube.
I looked at it in all sorts of different ways. So one of the things about doing this kind of work is that you can never use one way of looking at the sample to understand what's in there. So I'd use very high-powered light microscopes, very high-powered electron microscopes. But then we can blast the sample with a laser and look at the products coming off and look to see what's in there. I can look at a number of experiments where we use different what's called mass spectrometers to look at the speciation of the molecules coming out. So there's lots of different techniques I can use to understand this. And in one of the techniques we used, we dissolved away some of the rock and some of the carbonates in there and used a TEM where we basically almost at the point of imaging individual atoms in the samples. So all sorts of different techniques. I'm not married to a single technique. To get the complete picture, you must look at it in its entirety from every angle that you possibly can, and then make up your mind based on the data and your hypothesis as to what's in the sample.
I find it fascinating that this particular meteorite landed in Antarctica, a very, very cold place in the world. I'm not exactly sure where it landed, but let me follow up by saying it might be shocking to some to know that there's even life in the spot where that meteorite landed.
It's true. I mean, at the time, people assumed that Antarctica was virtually sterile, but what we're finding is an awful lot of organisms retreat in extreme environments into rocks. They love rocks. I mean, if you look at a meteorite...
And rocks have spaces.
Absolutely. They're completely porous. And in the meteorite sat on the ice. So the reason we go to Antarctica, because a rock is black, the ice is kind of a bluish colour, and you can see them. They stand out. If there's a rock in the middle of an ice field, there's only one place it came from. So you can go and collect them off the ice. But when it's sat on the ice, the air is full of spores, just the same as anywhere else on the planet, maybe less than most places. And the rock itself is black and absorbs sunlight and heat and then starts to wick water through these pores and becomes a very habitable environment for any organisms hanging around us. It's warm, it's liquid water, there's nutrients in there. And so it becomes a really, really nice place, comparatively speaking, to the environment around it for organisms to live.
I would assume that gives you a lot of hope and belief that eventually we will find either microbial life or some form of life, if not on Mars, somewhere.
There are two reasons to really, really look. One is to understand, you know, whether or not Mars had the conditions to form life. And the second is, if not, why not? And what does that say about our planet and where we come from and the origin of life on Earth? And so it's extremely important to look, not only to tick the box, are we alone, but also to tick the box, where do we come from? And so the search, from what we know from science and how life, from a scientific standpoint, started on Earth, then extrapolating that to the rest of the solar system, where we found all these wonderful planets suddenly in the last 10 years or so, the probability is that it must be out there, mustn't it? And if not, why not? What's so special about Earth? And if it is special, we need to understand that and understand our place.
And I love how you said that the basis of your research is in the negative. In other words, I assume this is not going to be life, and I look to prove that wrong. Well, when we go out in space and we do this research, or anywhere, how do we get beyond our preconceived notions? In other words, is it possible we could have stared new life in the face and not recognized?
There's always the possibility. I mean, one thing that science is about is not absolutes. It's about highly likely, most probable, out to the nth degree. In some cases, you know, gravity exists. We know that, you know, so.
And yet we still don't fully understand it.
We still don't understand it. There are, you know, absolutes in science. But if you're searching for something, you naturally make assumptions. And making those assumptions is based on a probability basis. It's the best assumption you can make given the circumstances. And the reason why science is progressing is because those assumptions get looked at again and again down the line, and if they're blatantly wrong or have changed based on current knowledge over time, these assumptions shift and are refined, and that's the scientific method.
Isn't also the scientific method is a big mistake often yields results we never thought?
Yes. I think the Alan Hills debate in the case of the Martian meteorites has been one of the most...
Explain that to our listeners.
The debate initially on life in the meteorite we just talked about, Alan Hills 84001, was an extremely healthy debate to have. And either way, even though my research has shown that there is non-life explanations for almost all the evidence in that meteorite, it doesn't mean that there may not still be evidence of life in there because of the hypothesis-driven way you look at it. I cannot disprove my negative hypothesis. So it still leaves open the possibility that there could be life in there. And the next set of observations and the next set of experiments and instruments that yet conceived may make those measurements down the line. But it has led to an understanding of the problem that is much better than we had before. The problem is much more highly defined. I think we have a better way of looking at the problem from having gone through those debates. And I think it in itself has led to the most healthy and robust of debates about how we actually would do that on Mars or Europa or elsewhere. So I think it's been very, very positive.
And science is filled with these debates when it comes to the origins of life, including the Big Bang Theory. And, not so long ago, realizing the universe is a continual expansion.
Yeah, it's a continual movement towards a common understanding, which means that competing theories aren't necessarily all right, all wrong in either respects. It is the debate and the consensus of opinion brought by debate that is the most important part of this.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Andrew Steele continues with a look at his lab and colleagues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1221. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Andrew Steele, a researcher at the Carnegie Institution Geophysical Laboratory. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
One of the real advantages about working at a place like the Carnegie is that basically the institution invests in the individual staff scientists to follow the science that they want to do and help with resources for you to do that. And then it's our job to bring in grant money and work with postdocs on problems that really stimulate us and stimulate the institution. Astrobiology being a great example of that. It's a great collaboration there that we have lots of people doing all sorts of different things from a scientific discipline point of view. We have, astronomers, geochemists, geophysics, organic chemists, microbiologists, all working together on different aspects of the problem, from trying to detect life elsewhere in the solar system, understanding how planets form, understanding how life formed on Earth, searching for life elsewhere in the solar system. And I think there's been a tendency recently, over the last 20 years, to really look at the boundaries between traditional scientific disciplines and really become interdisciplinary. I am a microbiologist by training, but I work on meteorite now. I'm doing Mars research. I'm trying to understand petrology, which is how rocks and minerals form and in that process possibly do organic chemistry. And the reason I'm doing that is to answer my initial premise. How do I find life elsewhere as a microbiologist? How do I do that? Well, I must understand the context of the measurements that are being made, and therefore I must understand geology. So I'm forced to go that way, sometimes to the hilarity of my colleagues, as I stumble through learning this stuff and learning geology. They're mostly very forgiving, thankfully.
Especially if it reveals answers. I mean, I love the way you said at the fringes of these disciplines, because it's in those gray areas and those where they intersect that we're really learning the mechanisms, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is some great juxtapositions between what one field takes as red. This is this. And then another field, it is not quite as kind of hard fact. So what you generally find is as the two disciplines come together, it uncovers areas of interaction that breed new investigations, and sometimes in an area where the initial thought was wrong or misplaced or outdated or outmoded. Certainly an example could be the microbiota in Alan Hill's 84001, where looking at that lot really carefully showed Earth life in there when techniques were saying there was no life at all. That's just a small example, but at the interplay between the two, then microbiologists and geologists come together and discuss things. A geologist may say, well, life should have this signature. And the microbiologists say, well, yes, but not in these environments and not in this context. And that, you know, automatically then will suddenly open up an area of research. Well, in these rocks, we say this. And it's, well, that's not necessarily the case. Or vice versa, I may say, you know, an organism will do this, and a geologist will say, not in that environment or not on those rocks because of this, 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 and this. And so all of a sudden you get a clearer way forward, a path of inquiry where you can generate a hypothesis to discuss and then go away and either observe, study, collect samples and look at, or experiment in the lab.
I would assume you have your fingers crossed that curiosity will bring something that is new life that you could use as a way to match anything you're looking at that may have been contaminated by Earth life.
Well, I think I will keep everything crossed. Yeah, there's no doubt. Looking at the way curiosity will go about, it's not a life detection mission per se, but certainly it shouldn't miss signs of life. It's very obvious. Like if there's an elephant going in front of a camera, we should see.
Well, here you are, taking this biotechnological approach for the detection of microbial life. It is I have to imagine, a very life-affirming task for you, since you told us at the beginning of this interview, this is something you've been thinking about, at least the idea of looking up and what's out and beyond there. So I wonder if, you know, I assume you still look up, but if you look forward for a moment, do you see that at some point not only will we be able to find these signatures, but perhaps there'll be some device, like a spectrometer or something, that recognizes them almost instantaneously. And before long, with all these collaborations, we're going to have an even greater understanding and perhaps we'll have answers to some of these questions.
Well, there's two components, really, to that question. One is within our solar system, and the other is outside of our solar system. And the technology and techniques that we need to develop, one, you can only ever remotely see that. So, you know, the astronomers are there and James Webb Space Telescope and new frontiers in spectroscopy, etc., may show a signal of a pigment or chlorophyll, an imbalance in the atmosphere that shows industrial activity, or who knows. And that is going forward at a pace. The research on Mars, and the next step for Mars is to bring, after Curiosity, the next big landed mission is to bring samples back, or to prepare to bring samples back. And that's really exciting because getting samples into a laboratory here is where you can test multiple hypotheses. And like the lunar samples, the Apollo samples, they're the gift that keeps on giving.
Still need to keep them free from contamination though, right?
Yeah, and that's something that also is being worked on. And or at least understand what you're putting into the system and how that affects what's in there already.
Hmm. So we recently saw the Nobel Prize awarded to Dr. Higgs.
Oh, yeah.
And the Higgs boson, you know, this sort of basic building block at the subatomic particle level, and this CERN observatory that was smashing these particles together. And sure enough, he's lived to see the signature, and now he gets the Nobel Prize. Is this another way? I mean, you're looking at microbial life. I mean, this is very small. And now we go subatomic. You think there's any sort of unified theory that might come about?
Oh, that's way above my pay grade, I'm afraid. I really couldn't comment on that. One of the things about the microbial level is that it is, in fact, modeling the interactions of a single bacterial cell within 5 minutes of its life is enormous. On the scales of microbial life, time and atmosphere and the conditions outside mean very, very little. The hypothesis is that bacteria evolve really quickly because now they're resistant to antibiotics. But if you look at the number of generations of antibiotic-resistant bacteria since the time antibiotics were introduced, if you assume an average human generation of 20 years and an average bacterial generation of 20 minutes, in the 60 years we've had antibiotics, it equates to 130 million years of human evolution. Now, humans haven't been on the planet for 130 million years. So it's actually really quite slow. Time means a different thing at those levels. And interactions mean completely different things. And so at the smaller scale you go, relatively speaking, the reaction rates, the times for reaction, what is happening at those scales are really quite incomprehensible to us at the moment.
And we're also seeing research with microbes themselves in the human body.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there are more microbial cells in our body than there are of us. There's more of them than us, really.
And that those microbial cells, rather than antibiotics, if in the right combination, can keep us healthy.
Absolutely, and they do all the time. Each individual's microbiome is different. They can cause disease. If you believe the research in mice at the moment, they can cause obesity. They can cause type 2 diabetes because as a consequence of that. So understanding how the microbiome fits within the human body is extremely important to the future health considerations. Again, microbes interact at a level. It has really nothing to do with the outside world. And during that, you can have two different species of bacteria that completely cooperate with each other and say one produces a foodstuff that the other really needs and the other one produces a chemical that protects the first one and they live in perfect harmony. But then there are other bacteria and other interactions that really it's almost like chemical warfare at a bacterial level. You know, when food starts to run out, they produce antibiotics. Antibiotics are there to kill other organisms, other microbes, so that they can keep the food for themselves. And so there's this whole really complex interaction at an unbelievably tiny level constantly. So that when your natural microbiome is knocked out or perturbed, other things can take advantage of that and move in. And they generally do. Anyone just has to look at their garden and keep a patch and then take all the weeds and everything out and then just sit and watch what happens. And if you watch it long enough, you'll go from tiny little weeds to bigger plants, then to shrubs, then to trees. You know, the whole thing slowly changes over time. And that's the same with any kind of ecosystem, really. And we are an ecosystem to bacteria.
Again, that was Dr. Andrew Steele, a researcher at the Carnegie Institution Geophysical Laboratory, speaking with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, go to origins.rpi.edu. Closer to home, there are microbes that live in a much nicer climate, but have a little gas issue. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Sometimes things that appear quite simple can be the result of complex processes. Ken Noel, professor of molecular and cell biology at the University of Connecticut, explains the explosive results of the work done by microbes in the average woodland pond.
If a walk in the woods in the warm spring weather brings you past a pond, poke your walking stick in the mud at its bottom. You might see bubbles rise up. What causes these? George Washington and Thomas Paine asked the same question in 1783. They called these bubbles flammable air because they could light them with their torches. Today we call the gas in the bubbles methane, the stuff of natural gas. The methane comes from rotting leaves in the pond. It takes a microbial village to break down those dead leaves. Like a bucket brigade, the digestion products of one kind of microbe are handed down to a different kind of microbe. The first microbes break down the complex sugars found inside the leaves into simple sugars. Then other bacteria break down those sugars into acids, like acetic acid, the same acid in vinegar. Next, these acids are converted to gases, like carbon dioxide and hydrogen. The last bucket is handed to microbes called methanogens that combine carbon dioxide and hydrogen to make methane. Methane builds up in the mud because it is difficult to decompose, so it forms gas bubbles waiting for a disturbance, like your walking stick, to release them to the surface. Methanogens belong to a group of organisms called the archaea. Though archaea look like bacteria, they're not bacteria. The archaea and bacteria parted ways during evolution a very long time ago, not long after life appeared on the Earth. So those bubbles you and our founding fathers saw were made by the real founding fathers of all life. We all owe them our gratitude for holding up the bottom of the food chain on which we all depend.
That was Ken Noel of the University of Connecticut. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.